From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, stories about making the movies Knocked Up, The 40-Year-Old Virgin, and Anchorman. We talk with Paul Rudd, who co-starred in each of them. He produced and stars in a new independent film called The Ten, a series of 10 comic sketches, each loosely connected to one of the Ten Commandments. Also, music critic Milo Miles reviews two new instrumental albums that could be classified as jazz, or alternative rock, or perhaps even world music. It's not so easy to label the two groups Massacre and the Claudia Quintet. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Paul Rudd, co-stars in this summer's hit movie Knocked Up as a husband and father going through a pre-midlife crisis. He also co-starred in The 40-Year-Old Virgin as one of Steve Carell's friends. In Anchorman, Rudd played a member of Will Ferrell's news team. We're going to talk about making those films. Rudd's first hit film was 1995's Clueless. He starred opposite Jennifer Aniston in The Object of My Affection. In the TV series Friends, Rudd played Phoebe's boyfriend and eventual husband. He also starred in the films Romeo and Juliet and Wet Hot American Summer, as well as numerous Neil LaBute plays. Now Rudd is starring in the new comic independent film The Ten. It's a series of 10 vignettes, each loosely connected to one of the Ten Commandments. It features Liev Schreiber, Rob Corddry, Winona Ryder, and Jessica Alba. Rudd acts as the movie's MC, introducing each story and starring in one of them. Here he is at the beginning of the film.
Hi, I'm Jeff Riegert. Okay, good. So I've got the Ten Commandments over there, and I'm going to give you 10 stories. Each one of them correlates to one of the commandments. So let's get right into it. Sorry I was late, by the way. Long story short, my wife and... You know, I'm not going to go into this. All right, long story short. My wife and I were at Bed Bath & Beyond. We'd agreed to go in beforehand because she wanted to buy a hand blender and leave. I mean, we weren't going to make a big day shopping because... You know what? I'm not going to get into this. This is just going to get me really upset. And besides, you didn't... You didn't come here to listen to my right? I came here to give you these 10 stories, and we're already running a little bit late, so why don't we just do it to it, right? Let's get this body started.
That's Paul Rudd in a scene from the new film, The Ten. Paul Rudd, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
The team who made the movie, Ken Marino and David Wayne, co-founded a couple of sketch comedy groups. How do you know them? You always seem to be connected to all these comedians and sketch comic guys.
Yeah, I try and horn my way into any group that will take me. And they were one of them. I remember watching their show, The State, on MTV. They were part of this collective. And I met them about 10 years ago, I think, about 10 years ago. They were doing a play in New York called Sex, a.k.a. Wieners and Boobs. And so I met them there, and David gave me this script for Wet Hot American Summer, and I read it and thought it was really funny. And a few years later, we were able to make it. So we became friends in that period of time, but then during Wet Hot American Summer, I think that was really when we became good friends. And same thing with Ken and a lot of the people that were in that troupe.
Now, you've done a lot of comedy films. You've worked with a lot of comics, but I don't think you've ever done sketch comedy or stand-up yourself.
No, growing up, I was a big comedy fan. As a kid, I remember being really affected by Steve Martin's comedy records, and I used to love watching comedians on television and things like that. But I studied theater when I was in college and then went to a theater school and... didn't really pursue comedy, per se. I never wanted to be a stand-up comedian, and I'd never studied improv comedy or anything like that. I always liked it, but my background is different from theirs. And actually, a lot of the people that I've worked with, some of the people in the Judd Apatow camp, also kind of have Second City backgrounds or Groundlings, that kind of thing.
Speaking of the Judd Apatow camp, he was behind three movies that you've been in. He was a producer of Anchorman, he directed 40-Year-Old Virgin, and Knocked Up. How did you get to know him?
Well, I got to know him on Anchorman. That was actually where I met him. Speaking of those Steve Martin records, it does play a part in actually how I know Judd a little bit. I was at a dinner party a few years before Anchorman was ever made. And I was talking about fake names, and that one of my favorite fake names is Gurn Blanston, which was from one of those records. Steve Martin was saying that his real name was Gurn Blanston. And somebody at the dinner said, oh, that explains Judd Apatow's email address. So I went home and emailed him, and he emailed me back. I just emailed him kind of congratulating him on the, you know, reference. And so we kind of became pen pals, though we'd never met. And the first time we actually met was on Anchorman.
And he knew who you were. You were already an actor who'd been in movies when you emailed him.
He said, and I remember his first email back to me was that he was surprised, but he was happy because he thought maybe now he had an in for free Neil LaBute theater tickets.
So you'd already been in
I'd done some plays.
Was it The Shape of Things?
Yeah, The Shape of Things and Bash and, yeah, a couple plays that Neil had written. And so that was Judd's response, yeah.
Now, what do you think you and Seth Rogen and Judd Apatow have in common?
We're all Jews.
Okay.
Let's see. What do we have in common? I think that Judd, Seth, and I have, I don't know, similar reference points, I think. You know, I kind of have found this out with people who I've worked with in the past, that Steve Martin, that those records were very instrumental in a lot of people's lives. But I think that we have a similar sensibility, the three of us do, and a lot of the same things make us laugh. So it's just kind of nice to work together. Not only, hopefully, the finished product is good, but the actual experience of making a movie together is fun. You know, we spend months at a time together, so it's nice to enjoy the company of the people you're working with.
Now, you know, the basis of a lot of, like, Seth Rogen roles is that, you know, he's the nerd or he's funny looking, but he's going to get the girl anyways, or he can't get the girl or whatever. You're very attractive. So that kind of issue wouldn't be your issue. And Judd Apatow, I've never seen him. Like, I don't know if he has, like, physically self-conscious kind of issues. So is that a place that you all do or don't connect?
Well, first of all, thank you for saying that. But, you know, all of our, I think, our comedy or the things we joke about all stem from insecurities. And all three of us certainly have those. As far as me, I growing up, I grew up in the Midwest, and I was Jewish, and I was on Accutane. I had terrible skin.
Really?
You'd never know
that from your movies.
Accutane worked, I think, before they realized that it was poisonous. And I was certainly self-conscious about many things growing up. I was never a great athlete, and from, you know, where I lived, that was the thing that got you in the cool clique. And I just kind of dealt with all of that stuff by, you know, trying to make people laugh or telling jokes. And I think Judd was, you know, the same way, and Seth is the same way. We just, I think that was our kind of our defense mechanism and still is.
How old were you when your acne cleared up, and were you already doing plays, like high school plays?
It was in high school, and it was a couple of years there. I mean, it wasn't, you know, disgusting or anything, but I was a candidate for medicine. I went to a dermatologist because of it, I was probably, you know, in those formative years when you're a teenager and you're in high school and you're just desperate to be liked, and you want girls to notice you and not notice the, you know, papules and pustules on your face.
Oh, well put.
So, yeah, you know, that was formative. Judd, Seth, and I also have really, you know, a pretty healthy amount of chest hair and body hair, which is another thing that makes you self-conscious. You know, you just don't want to look like a Greek fisherman when you're wearing a turtleneck and it's just still coming out on top. You know, like Robin Williams.
You mentioned chest hair, so we have to talk about the scene of 40-Year-Old Virgin,
where
Steve Carell is getting his enormous amount of chest hair waxed, and and you're one of his friends who is looking on as it happens, and I read that, like, that was really a genuine chest waxing for Steve Carell. It was really his hair, and not prosthetic hair that was getting torn off.
It was his hair, and we obviously only had you know, a few takes, because once you rip that off, that it can't really go back on. So we had set up five cameras or something like that, and filmed it. that blood was real. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, let me go back for a second. When you were talking about the acne and you mentioned the pustules and papules.
Right, yeah.
Oh,
I had blackheads in my ear. That's a painful memory that I've completely buried until right now.
Oh, well.
I had a blackhead in my ear. And I remember finding this out in class one day. Somebody said something. Todd Shepard was sitting across. I said, oh, my God, is it bad? And his response was, don't worry about it, man. It's not as bad as people say, which made me realize that people had talked about it, that this was a thing. So that was yet another painful memory.
Oh, that's
that
is so come. Horrible.
Oh, yeah. It was tough.
My guest is actor Paul Rudd. We should hear a scene from another film. Why don't we hear a scene from, since we're talking about 40-Year-Old Virgin, why don't we hear a scene from 40-Year-Old Virgin? And this is a scene where you're sitting in a coffee shop with Steve Carell, who is the 40-year-old virgin, and you're trying to convince him it's time to end being a virgin. It's time to change.
Look, you got to take a risk. You got to risk it. Look at me. I went out with this girl for 4 months, and it was the greatest, greatest thing in my life. Until she this guy in an Escalade, I think. And, you know, instead of, like, saying, okay, what am I doing that caused this behavior, I dumped her. Stupid decision. I spent the last 2 years of my life regretting it.
Well, why don't you get her back right now?
Oh, because she's dating this pot dealer. Stupid, horrible decision. But, hey, that's her journey, you know? I got to respect that. I got to give her the space. She wants to be some immature little bitch and everybody. That's love, man.
It sounds horrible.
Of course it's horrible, it's suffering and it's pain and it's, you know, you lose weight and then you put back on weight and then you call them a bunch of times and then you try and email and then they move or they change their email, but that's just love.
That's really funny. you must feel so good when you get a great script like 40-Year-Old Virgin.
Yeah, you know, it's really fun, and it's fun working the way that we do. You know, when we're kind of involved in the writing of it, and we
how involved? Like, what's in that scene, for instance? What was your involvement?
Quite a bit. You know, that when we were kind of thinking of the script, we would get together and talk about our characters and say, well, you know, what should this guy be like, and what's his deal, and then we'll improvise some scenes and film them, and then they will eventually make their way into the script. Early on, Judd and I had a conversation, and we both realized or said that, you know, the guy who goes out with somebody for a couple of months and then years later still can't get over that person is funny. And in that scene, you know, we'll shoot it as it's kind of written in the script, but more often than not, we'll just go off of the script and then just start improvising. And most of that was improvised, although, you know, we knew the theme, so you could kind of venture off. The whole thing about putting on weight when you become obsessive and you put on weight and you lose weight, that was done specifically because when we started shooting that film, I was particularly heavy and actually was asked, the studio said, to lose weight. So I figured, all right, if my weight fluctuates in this film, this might be able to justify that. And that was strictly the reason why I said that. But, you know, it's a bit of a battle. It's another thing working with Judd. Judd asked me to gain weight. He likes it. He doesn't want anybody to be in very good shape. He thinks that fatter is funnier. And I think he's right. None of us are too chiseled. We're all pretty gooey as a collective.
How do you feel about putting on weight for a movie?
I love it. I don't like the taking it off part. But... as I get older, I'm finding that it's, you know, obviously getting harder and harder to lose weight, and it gets easier to gain it.
My guest is Paul Rudd. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Paul Rudd, and his new movie is called The Ten. At the end of 40-Year-Old Virgin, after Steve Carell marries and on his first night as a married man, he has two blissful hours of sex with his new wife. He looks up into the camera from his bed and starts to sing, "When the moon is in the seventh house," mm-hmm. Jupiter aligns with Mars. And then there's a whole kind of like video that ends the movie of the cast of the movie and then some singing Age of Aquarius in a park, singing it. And then there's choreography too. And in your choreography close-up moment, you're doing this kind of martial arts choreography move.
It's awkward to look at. Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of martial arts. It's a little jazz. It's kind of like a little show tune-y, a little Fosse and a little Chuck Norris. Yeah, it's kind of gross. I find it hard to watch. I really do find that a little hard to watch.
Why? Yeah. I think it's funny.
Well, that's good. It's embarrassing. You know, you throw yourself into the moment, and I'm not really trying to think about what it looks like. But I know that I've done moves like that before. Actually, I did a move like that rehearsing a play with Neil LaBute, and he asked me never to do it again. It was so disturbing to him. And I agree. I said, okay, I'll buy that. You'll never see it again. But then there was a version of it in that film.
Let's play another clip from one of your films. And this is a scene from Knocked Up, which also stars Seth Rogen. And this is a scene from early on. Your sister-in-law, Allison, who's played by Katherine Heigl, has been staying with you and your wife at your home. Now, the sister-in-law got drunk and picked up a guy at a bar and brought him back for the night. That guy, Ben, is played by Seth Rogen. The next morning, you're standing outside of your house with your young daughter in your arms, about to get into the car with her. And you see your sister-in-law and Ben as they come out of the house.
Morning.
Good morning, Allison.
Ben, what's happening, man?
Ben.
How's it going?
Ah, to be young.
Stop it.
You stop it.
Okay, see you later.
Alrighty.
See you later. Enjoy the day. Never do what they did.
I'm gonna do it.
You are?
Uh-oh. Someone's getting homeschooled.
That's Paul Rudd in a scene from Knocked Up. Now, your wife in this movie is played by Leslie Mann, who's actually married to the film's director, Judd Apatow. And the kids who play your kids are actually Judd Apatow's and Leslie Mann's kids. So does it make it any harder or easier to act when you're playing with the director's family?
It was easier, actually, because I've known his family for years. Iris, his youngest daughter, the girl who I was holding in that scene, I met her during Anchorman. She still actually calls me Fantana. I don't even think she knows my my real name. She calls me by my character's name in Anchorman, which is Brian Fantana. So just having the familiarity there was helpful. Leslie and I have known each other for years, and it's tricky with kids too, because Judd was really wanted to capture what kids are like and not have actors really, not have child actors. So I think it was a little more, the kids were comfortable because they knew most of the cast and the crew as well. You know, the crew on Knocked Up was a lot of the same crew from 40-Year-Old Virgin and Anchorman and going back to even Freaks and Geeks and Undeclared, Judd's television shows. So it really was a family affair.
One of your very funny lines in the film was when you're talking to your sister-in-law and Ben, played by Seth Rogen, and they're about to have a baby. And so you're saying, isn't it weird when you have a kid and all your dreams and hopes go out the window? Because you already have two children. When you actually became a father a couple of years ago or so, did you feel like any of the characters that you'd ever played who were fathers?
I think that Knocked Up was the first time I ever actually played a father.
You wanted to be one in The Object of My Affection.
I wanted to be one, yes, that's true. I did want to be a father. But this one was, I'd had a son not that long before we started shooting Knocked Up. And, I felt very, like, I did connect to that role in many ways. I could relate. It was all heightened, obviously. I mean, I think that my own marriage is actually in much better shape than the one I was in the film. But, you know, there, I understood those fears of having a kid and feeling as if your life might be over. You know, I know everybody says it's the greatest thing that can happen to you, and it will enhance your life, all of which are absolutely true, and I completely feel that. But before he was born, I remember thinking, what's it going to be like? I mean, am I going to feel like myself? Am I going to be able to do things that I do the things I want to do? And it's really scary. So, it was jokey, but I definitely could relate to certain things that character was saying.
Paul Rudd will be back in the second half of the show. His new film is The Ten. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of A World Undone, The Story of the Great War, 1914 to 1918, by G.J. Meyer. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. And from the Pew Charitable Trusts, releasing a new economic mobility project report on immigration and the American dream, at pewtrusts.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
That's music by the Claudia Quintet, led by John Hollenbeck. Coming up, Milo Miles reviews their new CD and a new one by Massacre, led by Fred Frith. Also, Paul Rudd talks about making the film Anchorman. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with actor Paul Rudd. He stars in the new comic independent film The Ten. He produced it with Ken Marino and David Wayne, who also wrote the film. Marino and Wayne co-founded the sketch comedy group The State. Paul Rudd also co-starred in Anchorman, The 40-Year-Old Virgin, and this summer's hit Knocked Up. He first became known for his role in the 1995 film Clueless. Let's play another scene from one of your films, and this is from Anchorman, with Will Ferrell playing the local San Diego star Anchorman. And in this scene, he's decided he's in love, and he's shouting it to three members of his news team, including you and Steve Carell.
Veronica Corningstone and I had sex, and now we are in love!
Did I say that loud?
Hey, pretty much yelled it.
Well, I can't help it. It's fantastic.
What's it like, Ron?
The intimate times? Out of sight, my man.
No. The other thing.
Love.
Yeah. What is that?
Well, stuff to explain.
I think I was in love once.
Really? What was her name?
I don't remember.
That's not a good start, but keep going.
She was Brazilian, or Chinese, or something weird. I met her in the bathroom of a Kmart, and we made out for hours. And then we parted ways, never to see each other again.
I'm pretty sure that's not love.
Damn it!
I love carpet. I love desk.
Brick, are you just looking at things in the office and saying that you love them?
I love lamp.
Do you really love the lamp, or are you just saying it because you saw it?
I love lamp.
You really want to know what love is?
Yeah. Yes, tell us.
More than anything in the world, Ron.
Well, it's really quite simple. It's kind of like... Gonna find my baby, gonna hold her tight, gonna grab some afternoon delight. My motto's always been, when it's right, why wait until the middle of a cold, dark night? When everything's a little clearer in the light of day, and we know the night is always gonna be here anyway. Thinking of you's working up my appetite. Looking forward to a little afternoon delight. Rubbing sticks and stones together make the sparks ignite. And the thought of loving you is getting so exciting. Sky rockets in flight. Afternoon delight.
That's a scene from Anchorman, and my guest is Paul Rudd. I love that whole scene.
Oh, I was sitting here listening to it laughing because, you know, there's another example of also of why these films are fun to work on, Adam McKay's movies and Judd's, and that is there's an element of creative fulfillment that doesn't normally happen on movies. That scene is an example. You know, a lot of that is improvised. Carell going around naming things, it was just off the top of his head. So we never really know what the other person is going to say. But about a week before we shot that scene, Steve and I were sitting at the news desk while they were setting up some lights. And I had listened I was listening to a 70s music compilation CD. And Afternoon Delight was one of the songs on it. And... you know, we were talking and said, we should learn Afternoon Delight because it's four-part harmony. And we thought that if we ever had to promote the film, like on one of the talk shows or something, it would be funny to sing it. And we mentioned that to Adam McKay, who said, absolutely learn it. That would be really funny. And so a friend of mine named Craig Wedren, who actually did the music for The Ten, was in town. And he came by the set, and he just kind of taught us our parts, our harmony parts. And it was forgotten about. And about a week later, we were getting ready to shoot that scene, and Adam McKay said, hey, why don't you guys sing Afternoon Delight in this scene? It would work. It was never really planned. It wasn't in a script or anything. And we hadn't worked on it. So we just said, okay. So we took about 20 minutes and went to the side and worked on it, and then we shot the scene. And then there it is.
That's such a great story. Now, did you remember Afternoon Delight from the 70s, or were you just catching up on it?
No, I did remember it quite. My parents loved that song. My mom, in particular. It was actually only my mom loved. My father was too busy listening to military marches, so he was never kind of hip to what was, you know, popular on the radio. But the Starland Vocal Band 8-track was, you know, played. quite a bit in my house growing up.
And did you like the song at the time, or did it seem silly to you?
I didn't know what it was about.
I thought
it was about fireworks because there was skyrockets in flight. And until I really listened to the lyrics, I never really kind of figured it. I think I was in my 20s when all of a sudden I was like, oh, wait a minute. Oh, my goodness. I know what that song's about.
Another song but, secretly about sex.
but I remember thinking the voices were pretty. Before I understood harmonies and things like that, I remember thinking, I like the way they sing.
I read an article about you that made it seem like you go to karaoke bars and sing a lot.
Again, something I don't admit proudly. But I have, I'd say in the last couple of years, gone to karaoke more than I should. I don't do it, you know, like once a week or anything, but, you know, Ken Marino and a lot of these guys, like we've just kind of discovered karaoke, and there are these places where you can rent a private room. So we usually get a group of people and we roke. We do it enough that we actually call it roking, which is also awful that you would say that.
What are your favorite records to karaoke to or to roke to?
To roke, what are some roking staples? You know, it started off where Wichita Lineman was the one that I would do.
That's got a real high note in it, you know.
It does. And I think that some, you know, when I hit it, there's a real pride. I feel real pride in that when I do. But the thing is that I started, you know, roking with a lot of the same people. So and no one wants to hear that, you know, Wichita Lineman, which is a fantastic song. But, you know, you don't want to hear the same people singing the same song. So we all try to mix it up. So I was on a big kick, Kiss and Say Goodbye, the Manhattans. I was on a kick of that for a while. And what else was I doing? Guitar Town by Steve Earle. When I see that in a book, I usually punch in that number.
Now, I got another question for you about Anchorman. There's a scene, there's a rumble scene, a very funny rumble scene in Anchorman where all the local news teams are rumbling, and it starts off with, you know, switchblades and chains, and then the scene ends up being a parody of, like, Western fight scenes and barbarian battle scenes.
Right.
It's really a scream. Now, you know, there's always, like, the chaos of war, even in when you're shooting a war scene. Is there a comedic chaos of comedic war? I mean, like, what was it like to shoot that scene?
That was one of the hardest sequences to shoot. It was outside and it was really hot and there were a lot of people. So just the choreography of it all and the stunts. I mean, there was a guy on fire, you know, Dave Koechner threw a guy through a car window. There was the whole thing with Tim Robbins cutting off Luke Wilson's arm, so there was a lot of makeup and things like that involved. So it was time consuming, and it took a few days to shoot that sequence. So it was kind of the biggest thing in the movie to shoot, and it's hard when we shot it in the summer, the entire film, and it happened to be a particularly hot summer. There's a kind of a heat wave going through California, and I remember it being 100 degrees or so many days. And we were all in period clothing. I mean, we were in, these three-piece suits, and they were wool or polyester. And it was pretty uncomfortable. And so, you know, when you get about 60 guys dressed up in that kind of stuff in 100-degree weather and trying to fight each other, it can get a little trying to me anyway.
My guest is Paul Rudd. He stars in the new independent film, The Ten. His other films include Knocked Up, Anchorman, and The 40-Year-Old Virgin. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actor Paul Rudd, and his new movie is called The Ten. Your parents were British. You grew up in New Jersey, and then, I mean, you were born in Passaic, New Jersey, and then grew up in Kansas.
Right.
Why did the family move to Kansas?
My dad used to work for TWA, and TWA's hub was in Kansas City. They're both from London. And I was born in New Jersey, and we moved around a lot because he just kept getting transferred. He was a sales manager, and so you know, I lived in New York, and then I moved to Kansas for a year when I was about five or six, and then I moved to California for a few years, and then we moved back to Kansas, and TWA moved their hub to St. Louis, and we were in Kansas for the second time for about a year, and he was just tired of moving, so he quit, and we stayed.
Your parents were British. Did they seem very different than your friends' parents?
They did. Yeah, they did. And the one thing that I remember, too, was that I would talk to kids in school, and I said, where were you born? And they would say, here, in Kansas. And that was a really strange concept to me, that you actually lived in the place that you were born. And then I say, well, where are your parents from? And they said, here, they're from Kansas. And I couldn't wrap my brain around that. My parents were European. Also, not that I'm religious in any way, but growing up Jewish in an area that wasn't particularly Jewish, in a school where there weren't like a lot of Jewish kids, I did feel a little different.
How do you think moving around so much affected your speech? Like, I don't think I hear an accent when you speak, a regional accent.
Well, I think it's pretty neutral. And actually, in Kansas City, I think most of my friends have somewhat of a neutral dialect. It isn't like, you know, if you go further south and get into Oklahoma, there are certain twangs that you hear, and certainly the South and things like that. But yeah, I became kind of... I think it just became a little generic from moving to different places. And then as a kid, when I was learning to speak, my mom says that I got very mixed up, and I would, say, like, I needed to take a bath, but I wanted to eat a banana, because my mom still has her right. accent. So it was a little confusing, but I guess at the end of the day, it's just kind of come out like this now.
You said that, growing up in Kansas City, there weren't a lot of Jewish kids there. But you did, early in your career, work as a DJ for bar mitzvahs. I assume this was in Kansas?
No, actually, this is in California. And actually, Kansas City has a sizable Jewish population. There's Jewish populations everywhere. But it just happened to be in my school that, I was teased and things like that because there weren't a lot of Jewish kids in my school. As far as DJing bar mitzvah and bat mitzvah receptions, that was... that happened when I was in California, and I'd left college, and I was in an acting school, and I worked on weekends, and I worked for this company and did different parties. But most of them, you know, they were like weddings or birthday parties, things like that. But I would say the majority of the things that I did were bar mitzvahs.
What were your favorite themes at themed bar mitzvahs?
I had no favorite themes. It was a tough gig, and sometimes you'd have two of them a day, and that was another thing that was strange to me in Los Angeles. Bar mitzvahs, you know, people would spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on a bar mitzvah, and they would have themes, you know, like the Lakers or the Indiana Jones theme, and then I think back to my bar mitzvah, which was, I went back to my grandmother's house and she made kugel. That was about it. The theme at my bar mitzvah was back pain. That was everybody, it was just like a bunch of altacacas walking around handing out envelopes. But it was such a production. It really startled me to see all of these kids growing up so quickly and the money that was spent on these parties. It was more than weddings.
Almost like Super Sweet 16, right?
Yeah, which is another thing. Like, when did that happen, that you would spend all this money on a Sweet 16 party? That just seems...
So what were your favorite records to play at the bar mitzvahs?
Well, my favorite records to play were not really the records that I could play. There's a trick when you're building a set for a bar mitzvah. You have to really try and cover your bases because you have a lot of kids that want to hear what's popular at the time, but then you also have a lot of grandparents that would like to hear what was popular during, their time. So Glenn Miller would get everybody out on the floor, but then eventually, you know, Can't Touch This would come on, and the kids would go crazy, and all of the older set would leave the floor. So, you know, Can't Touch This was really popular at the time. Right Said Fred, the I'm Too Sexy for My Shirt, was a real favorite for a summer.
When strangers meet you on the street and they recognize you, what do they say?
They usually say, you know how I know you're gay? That would be the first thing from a 40-year-old virgin. And then they'll sometimes say, how's Phoebe? Because I would get some friends, like when I did some episodes of Friends and I dated Phoebe, I guess I married Phoebe. They'll sometimes ask me that. Or they'll sometimes say, how's Alicia Silverstone?
From Clueless.
Tends to be one of those three things, yeah.
Well, Paul Rudd, it's been great to talk with you. I want to thank you a lot.
Thank you very much. I've had a nice time.
Paul Rudd stars in the new comic independent film, The Ten. On Thursday, we plan to feature an interview with Peggy Young. She's done backup vocals for her husband, Neil Young. Now she's up front in her first solo album. Here's a track from it. It's a song she wrote called Fake. Coming up, Milo Miles reviews new instrumental albums by two groups, one led by John Hollenbeck, the other by Fred Frith. This is Fresh Air. Critic Milo Miles has a review of a pair of what he considers rarities, instrumental albums that don't belong to a clear school or style of music. But in the case of the band Massacre and the Clodia Quintet, Milo says that's a good thing.
Usually I'm put off by instrumental albums when I can't quite decide what type of music is being played. Either the performers lack personality, or by doing a little bit of this and a little bit of that, they're trying to be all things to all listeners. On occasion, though, an elusive style is not a muddle, but a harmonious, unfathomable fusion. Such is the case with the Clodia Quintet, led by drummer and composer John Hollenbeck, and the group Massacre, led by guitarist and composer Fred Frith. The Clodia Quintet's new album is its fourth, and it's called Four, but because all the tracks are dedications, that's F-O-R. On the surface, Hollenbeck could be considered a jazz man because of his longtime association with Bob Brookmeyer's big band and others. Certainly Chris Speed, who plays tenor sax and clarinet in the Claudia Quintet, is a celebrated jazz blower. But the Claudia Quintet is liable to be filed in the alternative rock section in stores. Hollenbeck and Speed, as well as accordionist Ted Reichman and vibraphonist Matt Moran, have played in world music ensembles with Balkan, Middle Eastern, and Brazilian touches. Finally, bassist Drew Gress has released solo albums of sounds as unclassifiable as the Claudia Quintet's. It's the quicksilver texture changes of Hollenbeck's tunes and the ever-shifting focus on lead instruments that pull the quintet's sound into a coherent conversation. The Claudia Quintet's numbers may seem tidy, but they produce a sensation of freely flowing sounds and ideas. Four is one of those albums you slip on at a gathering, and somebody is bound to be captivated and ask, "Who is that?" On the other hand, Massacre gets attention like a sledgehammer. Fred Frith formed the band way back in 1979 as a thinking musician's power rock trio, which meant dissonance and zigzag tune structures. The group disbanded quickly but reformed in 1998 with Frith, original bassist Bill Laswell, and new drummer Charles Hayward. With the new live set, Lonely Heart, Massacre finally gets the muscle to equal its brains. The group's fascinating simultaneous soloing interactions stand out in this quiet passage of the nearly 20-minute number, Send. Massacre presents a coherent conversation. It's not the shouting match you might expect, but rather like declamations or recitations. There's another track on Lonely Heart that's more than 18 minutes. Fred Frith is a masterful declaimer, though, restless, churning phrases and switching moods with a grand veteran's confidence. One of the shows here was at a European festival opening for Metallica. One hopes some fans weren't expecting a death metal band also called Massacre. But they obviously warmed up to these old art hippie renegades. Love of racket unites the generations. We'll be right back. What secretly delights the metal crowd is control at the core of apparent chaos. Nothing better than a band like Massacre, who can seem to be head down charging, really tearing up the pea patch, and suddenly snap into precise silence, masters of their madness. Even if you can't quite give the madness a label.
Milo Miles is a music critic based in Boston. The Claudia Quintet's Four is on the Cuneiform label. Massacre's Lonely Heart is on the Zodiac label. You can download podcasts of our show by going to our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sherrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menhivar. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Somerset Maugham's novel, Of Human Bondage, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Bill & Melinda Gates Foundation, working to ensure that more students graduate from high school ready for college work and citizenship, gatesfoundation.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the creators of Big Love, the HBO series about a polygamous family that broke away from a fundamentalist Mormon compound in Utah. We talk with Mark Olson and Will Sheffer. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.